Today is Wednesday, December the 8th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Windows 11 is significantly slowing down some NVMe solid-state drives. Windows 11 is once again causing some issues for users, this time with numerous reports of slower performance of NVMe solid-state drives using the operating system. The reports can be found on multiple Reddit threads as well as on Microsoft support forums, and they're actually not new. Reports on this problem goes back a few months, when Windows 11 is still in preview, but the complaints persist 2 months after launch. According to the reports, backed up by Crystal Disk Mark and AS Solid State Drive popular benchmarking applications for PC drives, performance on Windows 11 can be multiple times slower in some cases for NVMe drives. The problem specifically affects random write performance, with most other metrics unaffected, but the difference is still very significant. The source of the issue hasn't been clearly identified yet, but some possible causes have popped up. One thing that users initially pointed to was the virtualization-based security, that's VBS, causes the solid-state drive performance to drop, but it doesn't make up the entirety of the difference between Windows 10 and Windows 11. A more recent discovery suggests that the issue has to do with which drive contains the Windows 11 installation. If you run the benchmark on a secondary drive, the results will be in line with advertised values for the solid-state drive. The Samsung 980 Pro is a PCIe Gen 4 solid-state drive, but older PCIe Gen 3 drives are affected too. The difference is especially stark on a drive with theoretical speeds as high as this one, with the non-Windows drive being almost 5 times faster. Another recent report claims that the latest Windows 11 update, build 22000.348, slightly improved solid-state performance, though it still improved solid-state drive performance, though it's still a far cry from what was seen on Windows 10. A Microsoft engineer on Reddit acknowledged the issue 3 months ago when Windows 11 was still in preview, but it seems that a fix didn't make it in time for launch, and 2 months later, the problem persists. As users shine more light on potential causes, hopefully Microsoft will get around to fixing the problems more quickly. Windows 11 has been affected by a few issues already, including some that specifically reduce the performance of AMD processors, plus some apps simply not working. Those issues have received fixes in the meantime, so we can only hope that the same will happen here. Yes, Windows 11 is in prime time, but I'm not in a rush to put it on yet on my existing production systems. Google TV adds more than 300 free channels to its live tab with Pluto TV. Free streaming baked right into the live tab. Google TV is adding yet another cord-cutting option to its live TV tab with the addition of Pluto TV. Google TV users now have even more live TV channels to choose from. Google TV will now support Pluto TV within the Live TV tab, meaning users can easily access more than 300 free channels from the platform's primary live TV hub. Pluto TV is the fourth streaming service to grab a spot on Google's TV's tab. Previously, Google TV supported YouTube TV, Philo, and Sling, all of which required paid subscriptions. Technically, Google TV already offers plenty of free TV services through its apps, but baking an ad-supported service directly into the Live tab is a much easier way to find live and linear coverage. Plus, rival streamer Roku already supports free live TV through its Roku channel experience. In addition to adding Pluto TV to its Live tab, new Google TV users can also claim 6 months of Peacock Premium for free, after which time it'll cost $5 a month. Peacock Premium gives users access to originals, live sports, on-demand movies and series, as well as WWE programming. Google said in a blog post that the new Pluto TV integration will be supported on all Google TV devices within the coming weeks, with more free streaming options on the way next year, 2022. Apple tells suppliers that the iPhone demand has slowed down. Just a little historical background information. The Swiss Army knife is billed as an essential everyday carry for millions of men and women around the world. Engineer, camper, and tinkerer and do-it-yourselfer knows that there's nothing like a Swiss Army knife when you're in a pinch. The original Swiss Army knife was first produced in 1891. The knife then was 3.7 inches long, 0.53 inches thick, and it weighed 3.2 ounces. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife have two blades so that the secondary small blade can be used as a backup when the primary large blade becomes dull due to usage. The Wenger Company was founded in 1893, also produced the Swiss Army knife. Wenger made a name for itself by assembling the largest Swiss Army knife of all time with the Wenger 16999 Swiss Army Knife Giant. The item was 9.3 inches long, 8.75 inches thick, and it came in at 7 pounds. The $1,300 Wenger Giant Swiss Army Knife set the world record for the largest multi-tool. Today, the Wenger Company no longer exists, and the model is also retired. Today is back to basics for the Swiss Army Knife. The factory makes 45,000 pocket knives per day. The law of supply and demand is a theory that explains the interaction between the sellers of a resource and the buyers for that resource. Generally, as price increases, people are willing to supply more and demand less, and vice versa when the price falls. The parallel for all this is the report on the sales of the Apple iPhone 13. Apple tells suppliers iPhone demand has slowed down as holidays near. Apple is suffering from a global supply crunch, is now confronting a different problem, slowing down of demand. The company has told its component suppliers that demand for the iPhone 13 lineup has weakened, that some consumers have decided against trying to get the hard-to-find item. Already, Apple has cut its iPhone 13 production goal for this year by as many as 10 million units, down from a target of 90 million, that's over 10%, because of lack of parts. But the hope was to make up much of that shortfall next year when supply is expected to improve. The company is now informing its vendors that those orders may not materialize. It won't be the blockbuster quarter that Apple and Wall Street had originally envisioned. Shortages and delivery delays have frustrated many consumers, and with inflation and the Omicron variant bringing fresh concerns to pandemic-weary shoppers, they may forego some purchases. That could mean skipping the iPhone 13 altogether and waiting till the upgrade next year, when its successor comes out. The Apple iPhone 13 is considered a modest update from the iPhone 12. iPhone owners in Japan showed less enthusiasm for upgrading with the latest generation, according to the Mobile Marketing Data Lab. Apple pointed to supply constraints as the company's biggest challenge. The constraints have hurt Apple partners as well, and there's now more strain on shoppers' pocketbooks. U.S. consumer prices rose last month at the fastest annual pace since 1990. Surging costs for food, gas, and housing are eroding purchasing power despite its stronger wage growth. Meanwhile, the iPhone 13 isn't as hard to find and get as it once was. Apple shoppers in the United States had been waiting about a month for the much-prized Pro model to be delivered. Now wait times are down to under 2 weeks. What the consumer primarily wants is a reliable, working cell phone. The Apple iPhone 13 Pro Max costs almost $1,100. Apple introduces new models every year with incremental features with added incremental rising costs. The incremental new features are nice to have, but it's not essential to a working, reliable cell phone. At some future point in time, the bloated features on a cell phone will no longer be a reason to purchase a new cell phone every 1 to 2 years. California's new math framework. Every 8 years, a group of educators come together to update California's math curriculum framework. This particular update has attracted extra attention and controversy because of perceived changes it makes to how gifted students progress, and because it pushes Algebra 1 back to the ninth grade, de-emphasizes calculus, and applies social justice principles to math lessons. Their intent, the framework's designers say, is to maintain rigor while also helping remedy California's achievement gaps for Black, Latino, and low-income students, which remain some of the largest in the nation. At the heart of the controversy lies a broad agreement about at least one thing. The way California public school teaches math isn't working. On national standardized tests, California ranks in the bottom quartile among all states and United States territories for 8th grade math scores. The proposed framework is a set of suggestions. It's not mandated that you use the framework, though there is a concern that it will be implemented unequally. There's a huge problem with math instruction right now. The way things are set up, it's not giving everybody a chance to learn math at the highest level. The question of how to close this gap has opened up another divide between math education experts and academic mathematicians. In July, hundreds of mathematics and science professors signed an open letter calling on the state to replace the proposed framework. Academic mathematicians say their input is valuable. Critics have said the authors of the committee should have consulted more experts in the STEM fields who are more familiar with the advanced education and training students need after high school. The process should have involved STEM faculty from top California universities with direct knowledge of what is needed for success as STEM majors. And some education specialists say the framework would hurt historically marginalized students the most by injecting too many social justice-related topics that distracts from the math. The way you get social justice in mathematics is to teach the kids math. It's not by dressing up mathematics in social justice. The framework's key sticking point in the approval process has been the framework's recommendation that teachers refrain from labeling students as naturally talented in math. This has led to accusations from parents and educators that it holds back gifted students. The framework also calls for more relatable and practical instruction, whether that be through using more inclusive pronouns or word problems related to real-world issues like housing and climate change. To critics, that sounds like dumbing down math. Critics and other parents say the framework does a disservice to the historically marginalized students groups by offering them a simplified version of math that fails to prepare them for the challenges of a career in science, tech, engineering, or math. Advocates of the proposed framework argue that critics are too fixated on protecting students who are already doing well in math. In California, these students tend to be white, East Asian, or come from more affluent households. The framework would not forbid districts from accelerating students in middle school. It does, however, recommend that middle school students all take the same sequence of integrated math classes that blend concepts from arithmetic, algebra, and other subjects with the goal of cultivating a foundation and comfort level with numbers. The framework recommends that schools postpone offering students Algebra 1 until the ninth grade or later, when it says more students are likely to be able to master the material. Delaying the Algebra 1 until the 9th grade, however, will require other high school math classes like Geometry, Algebra 2, and Pre-Calculus to be compressed so that students can reach AP Calculus by 12th grade. The framework's authors counter that taking calculus in high school shouldn't be necessary to enter a STEM field in college and beyond, especially because calculus can be a barrier to entry for Black and Latino students. An open letter signed by over 1,000 STEM experts condemned the framework for suggesting that teachers highlight the contributions that historically marginalized people have made to mathematics, take a justice-oriented perspective at any grade level, and use inclusive gender pronouns. A Wall Street Journal editorial that helped spark the national interest in California's math curriculum and conservative publications like the National Review have objected to the framework's occasional citation of A Pathway to Equitable Math Instruction, a manual that aims to show math teachers how they can use their class to combat white supremacy. The manual asserts that the current math in the U.S. reinforces white supremacy in a variety of ways. Its critic says numbers are numbers, so how can there be racism in math? The Webb telescope was not damaged following mounting incident. NASA says the $10 billion space telescope is now scheduled to launch on December the 22nd. A NASA-led investigation has concluded that a processing incident that caused the entire Webb Space Telescope to shake did not cause any perceptible damage to the observatory. Engineering teams have completed additional testing, confirming NASA's James Webb Space Telescope is ready for flight. That's a huge relief. This means launch preparations can continue as planned, with blastoff now scheduled for Wednesday, December the 22nd, 7:20 a.m. Eastern Time. Launch of the Next Generation Space Telescope was originally scheduled for December the 18th, but a scary mounting incident at a satellite preparation facility in Kourou, French Guiana, resulted in a four-day delay. Private contractor Ariane Space is managing the launch for NASA. According to NASA, the incident happened while technicians were preparing to mount the telescope to the launch vehicle adapter. The physical structure that connects Webb to the Ariane 5 rocket's upper stage. While this was happening, a sudden unplanned release of a clamp band, which secures Webb to the launch vehicle adapter, caused a vibration throughout the observatory. The event was troubling enough that NASA decided to convene an anomaly review board to determine if Webb incurred any damage as a result of the shaking. Engineering teams completed their tests on November 24th, finding nothing wrong with the observatory. This allowed for a consent-to-fuel session, during which NASA gave its approval. The Webb Space Telescope is an international project involving NASA, ESA, and the Canadian Space Agency. As the most complex and powerful space telescope ever built, Webb will make unprecedented observations of the solar system, Milky Way, and the universe. The project has been marred by numerous delays and cost overruns, but it appears that Webb is finally on track to make its much-anticipated exit from Earth, at least until the next bad thing happens. And we will hope that doesn't happen. Are you still paying for antivirus software? Many cybersecurity experts say you probably don't need it. Antivirus programs that were once must-haves for personal computers are no longer particularly effective. There's just no longer any reason for regular people to pay for antivirus software for their personal devices. It's a shift that highlights not only how computer security has evolved in the past decade, but also the way many people misunderstand the greatest threats to their computer security. Antivirus software still centers on its original use, looking for and mitigating software viruses. Because modern computer systems already do that, many programs now offer additional protection like monitoring the dark web to see whether someone posts customers' personal information, which experts find to be of little use. The greatest threats most users face are no longer from viruses, particularly now that so much personal computing happens over the internet. Antivirus software were once considered vital to prevent hackers from spying on online activity. But security experts now say that thanks to additional built-in security protections in most major browsers and VPNs, that's virtual private networks, are useful in only a handful of specific scenarios, like streaming video that is restricted in certain countries, or getting around government censors like China's Great Firewall. Some antivirus programs can offer certain benefits, such as tools that help users avoid email-based phishing campaigns that steal sensitive login credentials. Others can help prevent identity theft. But many experts agree that the built-in antivirus protections on any major system, a fully updated Windows or Apple computer, or an Android phone or an iPhone, already protect against viruses just as well as the major programs people can pay for. It's important, however, for users to keep their systems protected through automatic software updates offered by all major software providers. It wasn't always that way. For much of Microsoft history, computer experts worried that Windows machines were susceptible to viruses. And there were no firm consensus about what third-party programs people need to stay safe. But Microsoft Defender, the free and automatic antivirus program now built into Windows, has gotten so effective that it's as good as anything customers can pay for. I personally use it regularly on all my Windows systems. That doesn't mean malicious software isn't a threat, but newer devices tend to take care of most problems on their own. Hackers are constantly devising new ways to break into operating systems, and companies have to keep updating ways to stop them. Fortunately, the days of cybersecurity engineers writing patches for new, safer versions of software and just hoping users will update them is largely over. It's almost impossible these days to not have a fully patched Windows or Mac system because they're pretty much force updates. A survey by security.org, a cybersecurity advice website, estimated that nearly 45 million households still pay for antivirus software. It also found that people are increasingly more likely to pay for antivirus software the older they are, and that most have been using it for years. To be secure, employ password hygiene of at least 8 characters with at least 1 capital letter. Use two-factor authentication on accounts where available. Almost all of the tools everyone should be relying on to be more secure are free. Hackers today are most likely to target regular people by trying to take over their personal accounts for email, social media, or financial websites. It's easier to stop them when you know that their goal is to impersonate you and take over an account you want to keep private. That means using unique passphrases, several words together which are easier to remember than a string of random characters, because the longer password is, the harder it is for an automated program to guess. People should also protect every important account with two-factor authentication. That lets users use their phones as a second way to prove their identities to websites, which gives hackers an additional hurdle if they're trying to get into one of your accounts. Experts recommend using an app like Google Authenticator or Authy when you set up two-factor authentication rather than through a text message, which dedicated hackers can intercept. Some, for purchase, antivirus products come bundled with additional benefits that address more modern concerns, like monitoring whether customers' passwords have been included in a giant dump of stolen credentials or telling them whether criminals are sharing their personal information on the dark web. Windows 10 comes with its own baked-in antivirus solution called Windows Defender, and it is enabled by default by setting up a new PC. At the very least, that affords you some basic protection against the many malware threats out in the wild. But did you know there is an added optional layer that can keep your pictures, videos, work documents, and other files safe in the event of a ransomware infection? The caveat is that you have to manually enable ransomware protection in Windows 10, or more specifically, a feature called Controlled Folder Access. Microsoft has added to Windows 10 a built-in ransomware block. You just need to enable it. To enable it, type ransomware protection in the Windows search bar, or take the long way by navigating to Settings, Update and Security, click on Windows Security, click on Virus and Threat Protection, and then scroll down and click on Manage Ransomware Protection. This ransomware block is not new, but I only became aware recently, and it's great. Ransomware ranks as one of the biggest and fastest growing malware threats, with a massive 62% spike in attacks in 2020 compared to the year before. As for the ransomware protection in Windows 10, it does actually work. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series, Automation and Macros Revisited.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. It's time to talk computers and the workplace. One of the key areas that I work with is automation. And it's a combination of macros. It's a combination of robotic process automation, RPA, which is where you set up. It's kind of like a macro. If you know what a macro is, let's start off by explaining what a macro is. It's setting up a specific set of programming so that, originally we used to use this in Excel, and it would go to cell A1, and it would do a formatting on cell A1. And then you could have it put in information in A2, and then you could have it format A3 based on the information in A2, and so forth and so on. Now, it's just a series of commands in a specific order, and each of these commands does a certain task. Now, let's take this the next step further. If you have something that you do on a regular basis with your computer, you load up an Excel spreadsheet, and you then key in certain bits of information, but then you have to go through 5 different pages, and you have to go ahead and you have to do updates on each of those 5 pages, but they're the same updates every time you do it. You can write a macro for it, or you can write an automation for this. And each of these different levels of programming gets a little bit more complex. It gets a little bit more intense. One of the things I did years ago was I worked for a company where we had to close out, we had to do a trial close of the month every week. And that trial close, if somebody were manually doing it, that trial close would take approximately a full day. 8 hours to do that. I managed to automate it, so that nobody had to sit there and do it. The computer would just sit and it would process all of that. And because it was able to process a little bit faster, we got it done in about 4 hours. But it meant that we restored one work day per week back to the company. Yes, by nobody having to sit there, by nobody having to do anything, we saved roughly 20% of one person's time. 20%. That's a huge amount of savings. And it all depends on who it is that's getting involved. I will tell you, it was our CFO. And we can give you just a rough number. Let's pick a lowball number for a CFO, an in-house CFO of a company that has a matter of 200 employees. A lowball number, $100,000. We save $20,000 a year, allowing that CFO to go do other things by automating that. How much time would it take for me to do that? Well, if I managed to do all of that programming and I managed to fit all of that in whatever length of time, yes, it worked out really well. It was worth our time, him training me, my training the computer, to go through and to automate this. Automation is an important thing that we all need to be looking for. We need to be finding ways to cut down the amount of time that we are spending on the mundane tasks. If you are doing something, wherever you're at in the business, if you're doing the same thing every day and it requires no brain power, you open this program, you save, you do an export of the data, you then load up Excel, you load the data into Excel, you then process the data, but it's running, you know, you're basically going down, okay, I fill this column down, I then fill this column down, I enter in this formula, in this column, fill that down, and then you save that Excel file. Well, we can automate a lot of that, maybe even all of that. And that restores however much time that you would have spent every day. And there's a payoff time. There's a payoff amount in any kind of automation. If you've been doing the same thing for 5 years and it takes up 4 hours a day, and that's, you do that 4 hours a day for 5 years, if I can have somebody work for a month to automate that and to get it all foolproof. That means no manual entry is involved. No amount of mistakes are going to happen. Nothing is going to go bad. It's well worth it. As a matter of fact, if you're spending half of your time over 5 years, we can have somebody spend a year automating it. And it's still going to be an amazing payoff. It's a year and a half worth of salary where we can have you doing something else. Instead of the same, all right, do this, then this, then this, then this, then this, and this, and this, and this, and this. Yeah, it's a valuable thing. And that is one of the big, huge advantages to having IT, to having information technology departments, or even just skilled people who are good at writing Excel macros and various other automation tools that are out there. And basically assigning macros to those. There's a lot to it, and it's a lot of fun, actually. I get a lot of thrill out of it. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. What is the KISS principle? Keep it simple, stupid. KISS is a design principle which states that designs and or systems should be as simple as possible. Complexity should be avoided in a system, as simplicity guarantees the greatest levels of user acceptance and interaction. I have recently been recommending to people wanting to replace their Windows PC or looking to buy a computer for the first time to purchase a Chromebook. These buyers only need basic office functions, and their processing needs can be met with applications that run in the cloud. It has been rare that those who bought a Chromebook calls on me for assistance when their system crashes. What's the difference between Chromebooks and Windows or Mac OS or, for that matter, Linux laptops? Well, what is a Chromebook? A Chromebook is a laptop that runs on Google's Chrome OS, a lightweight operating system that largely relies on the Chrome browser as its main user interface. This means that anything you can do with a Chrome browser, you can do it on a Chromebook. Google designed Chrome OS, or the operating system, to run applications from the Chrome Web Store or the Google Play Store. However, you can get programs to run other than from those two locations. Many of these apps work even when a Chromebook isn't connected to the internet. Outwardly, a Chromebook and a laptop may look the same. And they do. A Chromebook is technically a laptop, but with a different operating system. Both the Chromebook and the traditional laptop are notebooks with the keyboard, camera, built-in screen, trackpad, and just like laptops, many Chromebooks are clamshells, while quite a few others have touchscreen displays and a two-in-one form factor. In terms of processing power, though, the typical laptop is still the go-to system unit. That's because typically they have more capable microprocessors, usually from Intel or AMD, and more robust integrated or discrete graphics powering them. Traditional laptops run on much more robust operating systems such as Windows 10, Mac OS, and the different Linux distributions. Chromebooks usually have lower performing chips and graphics inside. The Chrome operating system is lightweight. It does not need a powerful chip to run, and it keeps the cost of Chromebooks down. However, a handful of premium Chromebooks have been introduced lately, equipped with high-end Intel and AMD CPUs. Windows laptops and MacBooks usually require high-powered graphics cards and processors, as well as faster memory, which means they tend to cost more. And Windows laptops also usually have a lot of local storage, from a minimum of 128 gigabytes on the low end to into the terabyte range. Chromebooks typically include about 16 gigabytes of storage. This is because Chrome OS and the application it runs are designed to save the documents to the cloud. A Chromebook is a good choice for one who is primarily using the computer for web browsing and basic office functions such as word processing or streaming video and audio. Storage isn't a problem, as you can easily use SD cards as well as USB drives for file storage. For many, the Chromebook can meet basic needs with Google Docs, but you could also install Microsoft Office Suite on it. Hey, what did I just say? Microsoft Office Suite is also available online at no additional cost. The Chromebook is also just a hard device to break. If you installed a virus-laden program, of course not purposely, but you got tricked into it, the Chromebook can be wiped and factory reset with ease. This whole process does not need any tech-savvy knowledge, and it's done within minutes, unlike other operating systems. The traditional laptop takes time to boot up. It also requires maintenance updates. With Chromebooks, however, maintenance updates and security checking is done online, so you don't have to worry about it. Chromebooks very rarely crash, and when they do, a factory restart is a simple process to easily fix the equipment. In some ways, though, a Windows laptop versatility is a weakness, as there are more features available for hackers to attack on a laptop. PCs need regular maintenance to keep them secure, even if it's just keeping on top of scheduled software updates. Chromebooks require far less upkeep, and Google has developed Chromebooks with safety and security in mind. And there are defenses working behind the scenes to keep you protected while you browse the web. However, there are some tasks that are just easier on a Windows device. Chromebooks have traditionally struggled with direct printing, although now that has been resolved with the latest printers that has wireless printing. Accessing and organizing files can also be a bit of a pain on the Chromebook, but there are workarounds. The one way to determine if a Chromebook meets your basic needs is you could try using Google Chrome, the browser, exclusively as your browser on your desktop computer for a few days to determine whether you need more features than the browser can provide. Only use Chrome extensions and use online applications like Google Docs. However, Windows and Mac OS offers a far more complete computing experience, but Google operating system is much cheaper, scaled down alternatives that may be just what meets your budget. The primary advantage of the operating system on the Chromebook is boot up or startup time is literally in a single digit seconds. To power wash your Chromebook, such as to do a factory reset, sign out on your Chromebook user account. Then you press and hold Control plus Alt plus Shift plus hit the R key, capital R. And then when it comes up, click Restart. When prompted, select Power Wash and then continue. And you follow the on-screen steps to create a new user account. However, there are caveats for the Chromebook. Stick to the traditional laptop operating systems if you need to do any heavy-duty audio or video editing. Chromebook is advertised to be able to run Windows applications. However, to enable this, you will need to have either an Intel or AMD processor installed on the unit. many Chromebooks have Qualcomm and MediaTek chips instead. Having a RISC processor such as available on low-cost Chromebooks won't qualify to run Windows apps. With Chromebooks, there is a drop-dead date for maintenance support. It is not from the date of purchase. It is from the date of manufacture. It used to be that Chromebooks were only given a little over 6 years to live and only 3 years before that, with the clock ticking from around when the first model was released. Since then, Google has bumped up its support to a full 8 years, even extending an extra year to some existing Chromebooks. All of this means you should avoid, however, purchasing a Chromebook not knowing when it was manufactured, and in other words, avoid a refurb unit or used or a so-called manufacturer pre-certified unit. Chromebooks is not for everyone, but for those who just want to get started, keep it simple. And what does keep it simple means? KISS. K-I-S-S. Well, this is something slightly into the future until it goes into a product and it's in production. But Canon made a new image sensor that can take high-quality color pictures in the dark. The new sensor only needs 1/10 the brightness when compared to CMOS sensors. Canon made a new image sensor that can take high-quality color pictures in the dark. While manufacturers have been able to cram many millions of pixels into tiny smartphone cameras, sensors, and improve their sensitivity, Canon made a new type of sensor that's particularly great in low-light scenarios, especially when compared to conventional CMOS sensors. Canon has developed a new image sensor that is capable of taking high-quality color pictures even in dark settings. This could be a boon for photographers, but arguably even more important for applications like self-driving cars, surveillance systems, slow motion capture, time of flight distance measurements, and mixed reality. According to a Nikkei report, the new sensor can capture a very high amount of detail, as it only requires 1/10 the brightness that conventional sensors need to recognize light. To achieve this performance, Canon wasn't able to use the photodiodes found in conventional CMOS sensors, so it opted for something called a single photon avalanche diode, SPAD, instead. A SPAD, well, I'll repeat it again, single photon avalanche diode enables that increased sensitivity to light thanks to its ability to act as a linear amplifier when struck by even as little as a single photon. Canon says its new sensor can be manufactured using the same technique as CMOS sensors and could end up costing roughly the same per unit, assuming the same production yield. One area where the new sensor won't impress is resolution. However, its 3.2 million pixels do make it the world's densest of its kind and more than 3 times better than Canon's previous SPAD sensor. The company plans to begin mass production sometime in the second half of 2022 and is expected to integrate the new sensor into its security cameras by the end of next year. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. 2 bits on two-factor authentication.
Marty is with us this week. He went on some mission. We were talking about this. He went with Charlie Bucket to find some Whipple Scrumptious Fudge Mellow Delight Bar or something like that. I had fun while you were out. I mentioned a few different whimsical tales.
But, oh my!
ladies and gentlemen, my Google Assistant will respond to the phrase "play computer talk radio" or "play the new computer talk radio." When I say new, it's always the newest episode. When I just say "play it," it picks up wherever I left off last.
Very nice. I like that. I like that a lot.
You did it.
Well, yes, I did. All right, but that's another story. Now, hopefully you won't have to have two-factor authentication to talk to your Google device. Because two-factor authentication For some reason, it hasn't caught on very well. Let me go back in time. Marty, I don't think you knew this about me, but I worked in the early aughts. We're talking about 2001, somewhere in there. I was the sole point of contact for a international oil and gas company, the largest independent oil and gas company called Unocal. I was the single point of contact for two-factor authentication devices. I would prep these little RSA tokens and send them out to inter-office mail, or if they had a BlackBerry. Yes, back in the day of the BlackBerry, that we had the app for that. Also the Palm OS, we had the app for that, the two-factor authentication. It has advanced absolutely, I won't say absolutely nowhere, but it's been slow going. This,
you know, I have authentication apps on my mobile.
Yeah.
That Windows will use, or Adobe will use, or Experian will use to make sure it's me.
Yeah.
And that is a very smooth running version of two-factor authentication, but unfortunately no hardware vendor makes money at it, so it doesn't get promoted.
Yeah. Is that the why we haven't seen it? Just, I mean, we're talking 20 years. In 20 years, I would have thought that everything we did would have turned into two-factor authentication. It would have progressed. It would have, we would have a fingerprint reader remotely in order to allow us to access the bank, or it would test our DNA or something. It's gone nowhere.
Ben, with all respect for your time with Unocal, and you could have saved a tank of that for both of us, but with all respect for that, two-factor authentication represents an approach to user interfaces that I call Nazi-ware.
Okay, yes.
It is someone who is so paranoiac, I should say, someone who is so paranoid about the wrong people getting at what? The balance on their Amazon account, or whether they ordered something for their wife from QVC. I mean, really, what is there that they can steal? I've got stuff. That's fine. I understand that. But for two-factor authentication, one factor is enough. I have physical security, which means they got to break into the house to get down here. And if they're going to break in the house to get down here, figure out which keyboard is active, figure out which computer is active, figure out how to get the monitors back on, and then plug in and steal something. What are they going to get, an old tax return? I mean, if I'm lucky, they'll do identity theft and they can take over the bills.
Oh, my. Yeah.
So, you know, what are you protecting with two-factor authentication? Well, we have all of this customer data. Yeah, Bill's a customer, Ted's a customer, Mary's a customer. Being a customer is not actually usable data in and of itself. Customer collection of data used to be the bigger issue. Why are you recording social security numbers? Why are you recording email addresses associated? Why are you recording other personal information? And everyone who's ever done a database knows that stuff could all easily be tokenized and thereby unlinked. So two-factor authentication was a Band-Aid for its era. It requires you having something you may not have. You know, make it a wristwatch band with RFID in it, and that's your two-factor authentication source. Somebody steals that watch band, they're you. So, yeah, but you've got to remember a PIN code. Got it. A PIN code. Gosh, a PIN code. How many ways does it take? Three-digit PIN code, is that 909? No, that's 4,000 options. How long does it take to go through 1,000 options? It's so hackable. Why bother? Really, I don't like... Two-factor authentication is, number one, a nuisance. Number two, costs unnecessarily. Number three, is very well handled by today's authenticator as an app approach to it. Now, because everybody's had to tighten up, Microsoft and Amazon Web Services and Google and everyone else, I am no longer terribly worried about the wrong people getting the wrong stuff from the wrong place. Besides, I have portable hard drives.
There is that. Yeah, you had mentioned you you can't connect to your network at the office, so you just move your files to a flash drive and move it on over that way. Yeah,
and that way the network can't see me either.
And that's a good one too.
Yeah.
As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
And the two authentication factors.
I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, the next year, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation of Lightning Talks, Thursday, December the 9th. Meeting time, 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, December the 9th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. And this meeting is not at the normal meeting time. It was rescheduled to avoid end-of-year holidays. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is bcug.com. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is limac.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, December the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. Vax ID and mask required. The phone number for more information is 347-278-7320. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. With supply shortages, what is readily available as a suggestion for a practical computer-related gift is an external hard disk drive for backup. A new 1 TB hard disk unit can be purchased for under $40. For backup purposes, you don't need a solid-state drive. If there is an issue with budget, there are many hard disk drives available that were replaced with solid-state drives. You may have such a drive, or you may know of others that have a hard disk drive just gathering dust. An inexpensive external disk drive enclosure sells for $10 to $15. Be part of that 14% of computer users that are smart because they back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.